Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
And welcome to this. It is the second instalment of, well, what was this, the World Cup run that we're doing, Phil?
Yes, I guess so. And it's the second attempt at the second instalment of the World Cup run after an aborted start.
After a quick cough. I'm going to have to stop saying second, third. I'm going to lose count. We've got many, many podcasts to do.
I can't wait. We are going to watch a lot of rugby and hopefully record a lot of podcasts.
Well, something interesting happened yesterday in the world of rugby.
Is this not going to be related to the World Cup?
I can do what I want. Tim's in France. So, yeah, we played Warrington yesterday. Tokic played Warrington. Down by, I don't know, 16 to 19 points. Yours truly on the bench. Scrums aren't going well. Guess what happened?
I think I've heard this story before.
I think you have. About 10 hours ago. Yeah,
10 hours ago, and many, many times where you've been in a similar situation, and JB has come on to save the day.
Do you know what? I only had two scrums, but that's all it took to not just steady the set piece, but steady the nerves of my teammates to then score 50-odd points. Broughton Park lost to West Park St Helens. Go on, Arnie.
Yes.
Well done, Arnie.
Arnie,
yes.
Good lad.
What a guy.
Great lad.
Marlow lost, sadly.
Cocker's beloved, yeah. Marlow.
But Aylesbury did win.
Oh, fantastic news.
Thank God.
That is wonderful news.
It's nice, isn't it? Two out of three of us support Aylesbury. And one of us supports Marlow for inexplicable reasons.
Who everyone else hates.
Everybody hates Marlow. Except for Tim. So, I don't know. Do what he wants. In the same way that I can do what I want because he is in France. So, we'll get back onto more interesting rugby after we've covered off the small tournament in France. What did you see yesterday, except for England? We'll talk about England in detail, but what did you see yesterday?
So I watched pretty much the whole of Italy-Namibia.
Oh, okay. So that was very one-sided, probably more one-sided than I expected. I kind of thought, looking at the scores, Namibia might have fired a shot. They didn't.
They started okay. It was 8-5 at one point, or 8-7 at one point. But after that, you could see the conditioning of Namibia wasn't as good. And Italy they're a good team. They're well-drilled. They're spreading the ball wide in the second half beautifully. And they had a much more powerful rolling maul, which led to, I think, the first or second Italian try and subsequent yellow cards for Namibia. So it was... there is a gap. There's quite a big gap between those two teams.
Just whisper it. Whisper it very quietly. But I'm reading that Italian team. I'm looking at their Six Nations performances. I'm thinking, do you know what? This is one of the few times when you look at the Italian team, you think, that's a big name. That's a big name. That's a classy player. I mean, you know, maybe Stephen Varney isn't a top-end scrum half, and maybe that's putting it mildly, but he does a good job for them. And Garbisi is a top-class 10.
Yeah, Garbisi's a great 10. Varney's a very serviceable 9 who does have a lovely turn of pace.
Yeah, that's true.
And he's got to play some relatively simple tactics because he's got two excellent kickers and controllers of the ball in the back line in Tommaso Allan and Garbisi. Mm-hmm. And they mix those around. So Tommaso Allan started at 15.
Yep.
Tommaso Allan then moved to 10 and Garbisi moved out to
12.
12. and Capuozzo moved to 15 and Bruno came onto the wing and Paolo Dogu
yep.
came on, scored a nice try at the end, and he looked a handful. Because
he is a handful.
He's...
I mean, primarily, that'll be why.
He's 100 kg or so, but not particularly tall.
He's more
tall.
Than 100 kg.
Well, he's not very tall.
He's huge.
But
he's short.
He's very
he's
short.
Huge.
He's just very... He's very explosive. Very wide stance and low centre of gravity. So this is Italy team. Can they trouble France or New Zealand?
Maybe New Zealand, not France.
Maybe. Well, they only narrowly lost to France this year.
Well, you've read Soconomics.
Yes.
And one of the interesting things in Soconomics is when it describes football teams, and aside from the money that they spend, they point out that it's about, are your three best players better than the opposition's three best players? Now, with it being a 15-man game, obviously rugby's different to football, so maybe it might be your four best players.
Four, five, six.
And also influential players as well, I guess. There's no point in having the world's best winger in a team that can't pass a ball or some such thing.
Yeah, and I also think there is a... Like, football is more individuals. There is a team element to it, but the individuals are more important than in rugby. Like, it doesn't matter. You could have the seven best players in the world in a back line, but if your pack's getting pumped, it's totally irrelevant.
And I guess there are some positions where it is more individual than others. Tight head prop would be one. Your tight head prop is an absolute monster. That is actually an individual that makes a huge impact on a game.
Yes. Although, again, if you've got a great tight head prop, but
and
you've
nothing
got,
behind him.
Yeah, lightweight, yeah. Second row, back row. You've not got a tight head lock or indeed a tight head eight.
So where I was going with this is, Italy have got some pieces now, which are not maybe the absolute best in the world, but they could, man for man, be better than their opposition. Capuozzo would be one. He's a unique talent.
He is.
One of the best finishers in the world game at the moment.
Monte Ioane's brilliant.
Monte
Ioane. As well. And their centre combination, Maurici and Brex, very, very solid. They hit hard. Garbisi's excellent. Their back row is excellent. Legitimately
yes,
excellent.
Yes, that's where I was going next.
Canone is superb. Lamaro is superb. Negri's enormous and very, very strong. And the boy Zuliani, who came off the bench and scored a lovely try, albeit a bad missed tackle from the Namibian 10, he looked lively as well. So they've got options in lots and lots of positions.
Yeah, it's
now,
good.
We shouldn't get over ahead of ourselves because this was only Namibia.
Yeah.
And Namibia will be lucky to get a losing bonus point at any stage in the tournament. But it's a good Italian team that can trouble... Perhaps not win, but trouble the bigger teams. Although they do have to play, it's Uruguay as the other team in that group, isn't it? And I really like Uruguay. We've not seen them yet, but keep your eye on them.
Yep. Now, I'm going to link Italy to Argentina, and we'll come back to Australia at the end. Because everything you were saying then about the back row for Italy... It's basically the same as the back row for Argentina. Big, abrasive, can really play, probably some of the best players in that position. Maybe not absolutely the best players, but certainly in certain from certain angles, they're very, very good. Oh, hang on a minute. We're joined by rugby royalty. Hold tight, please, Phil. Cocker, how are you?
It's like I'm in a sweat lodge. People pay thousands of pounds to go like to the California desert and sit and sweat. I'm in a van outside the Stade Velodrome in Marseille, absolutely sweating buckets right here, just so I can speak to you.
Well done. Oh, God, isn't he humble? So humble, on the trip of a lifetime, and he's doing this for us. Thank you, Tim.
We appreciate it, Tim.
Don't we just? Wow.
No, it's absolutely awesome. So, yeah, I slept in the car park of the stadium last night.
Amazing.
Well, have you ever heard Adam Carolla as Rich
Man? Connected to the stadium Wi-Fi.
Have you ever heard Adam Carolla's Rich Man, Poor Man?
Yes, I love it.
So, do you know what Rich Man, Poor Man is, Tim?
No, I don't.
Problems that rich people have and very poor people have, or activities.
It's things that only the ultra-rich or ultra-poor, like, for example, travel by boat.
Travel by boat.
Or eat something you've killed.
Yeah, hunt your own food.
Yeah.
hang around all day in dressing gowns.
Drive 50-year-old cars.
Yes, yeah, drive cars which are much, much too old. I'm going to put sleeping in stadium car parks as a rich man, poor man.
Yes.
Tim, you have arrived at the perfect moment. So Jamie and I started this about, I don't know, 15 minutes ago.
Do you want to?
We have already covered off Northwest, and indeed most
some of the Northwest,
most of English lower level rugby, lower tier rugby, and we've covered off Italy versus Namibia. And we were just about to start. JB was just taking some tentative steps towards the big game last night. He was going to give us a comparison between Italy and Argentina to introduce us to that dynamic.
Yeah, now, before I go on, it's only right for you and the listeners. Do you want me to recap on any of the local rugby, Tim?
No, it's fine. Cov beat Saracens, that's the one thing I've heard.
Oh, God, yeah, there's Premiership Cup on. Oh, God, what a weekend.
We'll be going through that in detail, of course.
I'm not surprised that JB has been avoiding... what was it? Well, I don't know. So I would just jump straight in and go, there seems to be a slight difference between the general thrust of what people felt watching England on the telly, pleased with the win, but still not pleased with the performance. And everyone coming out of that stadium, I don't know whether it was the atmosphere, the day spent getting well hydrated down on the port, but everyone seemed absolutely, like, really happy with that. Well, how did you feel, Phil?
Happy. I was impressed with the way that England kind of fronted up after the red card and the way that they pressurised Argentina, and very, very happy with the way that George Ford controlled the game in numerous areas, controlled the overall kicking game, controlled the scoreboard, and just kept, one way or another, just kept the scoreboard ticking over with a... Did Ford have a perfect kick?
He missed at least one.
Well, Elliot Daly missed two, didn't he?
Yeah.
Did Ford miss one? But near perfect game off the stick. So I was very happy. And this is a very good Argentina team who've had some incredible wins in the past couple of years and have got, I think JB was going to come on to say, some very good, very experienced and great combinations right across the team. And they were put under a lot of pressure.
I disagree with the pressure, Paul. I mean, I do and I don't. So in open play, they weren't put under pressure. But they were territorially.
So open play, no, because England hardly ran the ball.
Yeah.
England played a very, very simple game plan. They kicked a lot. They threw men into the breakdown, made it a good contest. And they kicked a lot, both box kicks and kind of kicking tennis, and generally won the majority of those, the ruck battles and the kicking battles. And that's what created the pressure on Argentina.
Yes, I agree with that. I don't think they created any pressure defensively, really. They had some turnovers.
They didn't
need to, because what was frustrating, because I was watching this as a neutral. No, I wanted England to lose. Make no mistake about that. I don't want England to lose because I want English fans to be miserable or to teach England a lesson. I want them to lose because I want the RFU to lose their job. I want English rugby to be saved from itself, and the only way that happens is if England go out in the group stages. I don't want England to go out in that bitter sort of tribal way that people do. Far from it. I want them to be great, but they won't do it under this administration. So before anyone says anything else, that is my stance.
Yeah.
So from a neutral's point of view, it was very frustrating. Because Argentina are a wonderful team of ball in hand, and they were tearing chunks out of England. But they weren't given the opportunity, really, to get going, either by the referee, by their own mistakes, which are bloody brain dead. I mean, it was just poor. It was just poor what they were doing. And lastly, by England, who did a really good job of just stopping everyone playing rugby. And also, very...
You put them in that order. I put it in the reverse order. They weren't able to do what they wanted because of England, because of their own mistakes, and then you could maybe throw the referee on top, but it's quite revealing that you put that one first.
It's not revealing at all. It's revealing that that's what I watched. So, if you think about it, hang on, would it be revealing if I said the opposite? Would it be revealing if I said...
Yeah, it would be that you're putting
the
things that were most influential first.
Yeah, but what would it be revealing?
I would think it would reveal a more unbiased, fair assessment of the match.
Hang on. So it only is revealing if I agree with you, because that would be the right thing. But if I say it the other way, it somehow is revealing that I'm biased. Anyway.
Well, I think when we can talk about refereeing decisions and the whys and wherefores, but I don't like putting that first. You know, we talk about it all the time. There's no single point of failure.
I just gave you three.
There's a lot more that England, there's a lot more that Argentina could have controlled and didn't before you even need to venture into talking about any refereeing decision.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to put it on the referee per se. I say refereeing decisions. I think more accurately is Argentina's lack of ability to identify what the referee wanted. I think that's probably a better way to put it. And that's why it was brain dead. So there are so many mistakes. And I'm talking not about pressurised mistakes, where you throw the ball into touch or you get smashed in the contact and you drop the ball or things like that. I'm talking about things like they were going to deck and just dropping the ball. They just really, really basic things. And I don't know what their preparation was like, but they didn't look like a team that were ready. And if they could have capitalised on
the game in the last month and it was against Spain.
Yeah, is that all they've had? I mean, they've had the Rugby Championship
I think so.
Yeah, they had the Rugby Championship. They might have had one other game, but I flagged it a few weeks ago that there's a risk that they'd come in undercooked because their most recent game, and only one for certainly at least 3 weeks, possibly longer, was a 50-point hammering of Spain, who are not preparing for a World Cup in a very different stage. But then the counter-argument to that is Argentina had 3 months locked in hotel rooms and beat New Zealand away.
Yes.
Albeit, I think it was in Australia.
In Australia.
But, yeah. So that's not really an excuse for Argentina. You made a good point, JB.
It's not an excuse.
Failing to identify what Garces was looking for.
Yeah.
Like,
Reynal.
Sorry, Mathieu
Garces. Mathieu Reynal. They were absolutely woeful.
Yeah.
And how much of that is... You know, what's your perception from the stadium, Tim? How much of that was Argentina just getting it wrong? And how much of that was England putting them under pressure for lots of different reasons, some of which was the simplistic but well-executed game plan that England employed?
Yeah, I mean, I think a massive amount of it was England. Like, there's no question, the mistakes, the errors, and then they started trying too hard and it just got worse and compounded itself. But that all stems from the pressure that England applied through a tactical kicking game. I thought Alex Mitchell's, I know it's boring to talk about, but his box kicking was brilliant.
I don't think it is.
I don't think it's boring at all.
I think tactical kicking, when it's employed well, is fantastic.
Yeah. I had this conversation
And so England's tactical kicking from 9 and 10 was brilliant. I thought that they threw men into the breakdown, as you said, Phil. And like, I haven't heard an England crowd singing Umaru Itoji for a long time. And they did that a number of times because he was a menace at the breakdown.
I thought that
Ben Earl was an absolute wrecking ball and a menace.
And Courtney. Yeah. Courtney had a great turnover. Maybe two of them.
He got penalised early on for going too long or not supporting his body weight. But other than that, he was excellent. Those three were super. I said to JB when we were making a coffee before, Maro's best game, certainly in an England shirt, in 12 months at least.
I think you're probably right. Probably right on that. I think the England performance, there's a lot. You've just got to treat it as exactly what it was. I thought the tactics, although looked odd pre-game, worked out brilliantly. I mean, you can't argue with that. They've conceded no points and they've won handsomely.
The 15-point win in a World Cup match.
Exactly. Do you think it's a record for a win with no tries?
Could be. Isn't the like 99 World Cup where the Springboks?
Yanni De Beer.
Yeah, Yanni De Beer.
I assume someone must have scored an A try.
But probably. But isn't that the record for drop goals in a tournament?
Five, was it?
It might be.
Five or six.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's certain things which are just undoubtedly true. I thought they got their strategy right, as in their tactics right. Box kicking was great. I had to educate someone in Talk H about box kicking. They said, oh, it's so boring. And then we watch the reception of the box kick. Like, that's not boring. You know, when someone goes up, falls to the ground and eats grass, why is that boring? That's exactly what we want to see.
And if it is boring, so do you know how many times England kicked the ball last night? On a hazard, a guess?
30?
So it's 43.
Okay.
In other games this weekend, so Australia playing a comparatively weaker team in Georgia.
Yep.
Although we'll come on to that game because I thought Georgia... couple of chances, if they'd have scored them, it would have been much more interesting. But Australia in that game, they scored, they kicked 40 times with ball in hand. England, 43. France, New Zealand was 39 from New Zealand and 44 from France. So England were actually one fewer than France, and about the same as France, New Zealand and Australia comparatively. So it's, if you, like, we are not doing this. We are not criticising England for kicking, but if you were, you would also have to criticise Australia, France and New Zealand at the same time.
And I don't know what I'm about to say here or how I should express it.
Standard.
But I wouldn't be surprised if we watched them both, there'd be something about the kicking that we'd find boring for an observer. And I don't know what that is. Maybe it's the fact that kicks go to touch more, or the fact that, so if a kick goes to touch, it's a kick, but then you've got to wait 15 seconds to set up.
So let me give you another stat to align to this. So in the England-Argentina game, there was 541 metres run with ball in hand, which is not a huge amount, but it's not terrible. In the Australia-Georgia game, there was 1,260, so 2.5 times. And in the France-New Zealand game, there was 1,080.
Yeah.
So twice as much. So the difference is, there's a lot of kicking in those three games, a comparable amount of kicking in those three games, but the running with ball in hand in the other two games was significantly higher. And that was, I think, a clear tactic from England. They were kicking to shut things down, not kicking to then create opportunities to run.
Yeah, I agree. Also, if you're thinking about the kicks, how many marks were there? And then the mark takes 10 seconds off. And then
George Ford used that expertly to slow
exactly
the game down.
What you want to see. It's exactly what you want to see. If you're an England fan, I mean, George Ford was brilliant. George Ford was brilliant. You know, could he have faced better opposition? Yeah, potentially. But what he actually did with those drop goals is sort of opposition neutral. Mm-hmm. Those drop goals were absolutely incredible.
The first two as well. The third one was lovely because it's just a little dink when they're building to try and score a try. Yeah. And the first two from 50 yards out, which you saw Santiago Carreras have a shot from about that distance, and it was closer to the corner flag than it was to the sticks.
I felt it was a little bit like George Ford saying, "Okay, I've identified the problem, and the problem is you're all rubbish. So I'll take it from here." But there's also downsides, and I think England needs to be realistic about these downsides. The collisions were not good enough. Like, not by a million miles were they good enough. So if Argentina had got their act together on a different day, the line breaks that Argentina were inflicting on England could have been massive. And because they weren't, because they didn't score early, England were never in a position where they had to chase the game. If they had to chase the game, I'm not sure they could have pulled off what they did, because you've got to play differently. That'd be the first one.
I'm going to stick up for their defence here, which is another big positive. Yeah, we still haven't scored tries, so I'm not getting ahead of myself. And England have got a lot of improvement to make, and I still think there's a huge... The ceiling between pools A and B and pools C and D is still a big gap.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, even when Argentina made dents, England never lost their shape in defence. And you did get a perspective of that when you were in... I was quite high up in the stadium, looking down, and you saw the whole pitch, and that was the one thing that struck me was that they never got folded in defence, and they always managed to keep their shape. So there's obviously some work that's been going on, and it was a big improvement. Now, I thought
I'd say besides the last 5 minutes or so, which you can kind of forgive when you've played with 14 men for so long.
Yeah, you know, all the stopping and starting. If you've only got 14 men, you want to be exerting yourself in small violent bursts. That's what you want to do.
So your other point.
England, the try. Yeah, Tim just pointed out like, lack of tries, lack of attacking intent was bad.
Well, and on
14 men.
On that, yeah, it was a clear tactic. But on that, they did get a couple of turnover balls where they tried to go wide, and twice
screwed it up.
Basically, just everyone drifted and ended up just passing the ball straight into touch. Which made them...
Well, it was bad passes as well. Joe Marchant's pass to Elliot Daly was terrible.
Yeah, and there was one in the second half to, I think it was Mitchell to Johnny May. But the bad pass from Marchant that made an already bad situation worse, because everyone up to that Marchant pass had just drifted. So it just allowed, they had numbers, but it just allowed the Argentine defence, even if they'd have only had two defenders, they could just drift with the ball.
Yeah. The set piece was interesting. So Argentina's lineup was woeful. I'm sort of umming and ahhing, was that England? Was that Argentina? The overthrows were Argentina.
Yeah.
But some of the disruption, I think Mario might have disrupted one.
Big courts
got up there.
A couple of times.
But, you know, I find that unacceptable for an international team not to win the majority of their ball. I mean, if someone's stealing it in front of you, yeah, that's also unacceptable because you need to do something else. But they just wasn't good enough.
And on that, so in France, New Zealand, the line-out success of both teams was 90%.
Yeah.
France 92, New Zealand 90. But they both missed one line-out. England's was 100% success in the line-out. Argentina's was 73%.
Just not good enough.
That is not good enough.
Yeah, and all they needed really was one score early doors, and the complexion of this whole game changes. But they didn't get it, and that's the important thing to remember. They didn't get it.
Yeah.
So I think England should be happy with this win, because I thought it was a complete coin toss if they'd win it. I think if they played again, it'd be a coin toss again.
I thought I had Argentina as favourites. I said it last week. Yeah. In my head, they were favourites going into this. And to play for 77 minutes, a man down, or rather 67 minutes because of the Carreras yellow, I thought that's... this is the kind of result and performance that England needed to just turn the tide on public perception, probably their own perception of their ability. So... As an English fan, I am pleased to see that. And it's now how they build through the next few games leading up to the final game. But you'd say, unless something goes disastrously wrong, England will be in a quarter final.
Yes, I agree. I completely agree.
Popping the ball in a quarter final.
So, say again, sorry?
Popping the ball as well.
Hopefully, yes. Could they lose to Samoa or Japan? It's not impossible, but you'd hope not.
No.
Yeah.
So,
can we just briefly? I don't want to labour it, but just I spoke to a lot of England fans. Well, and
quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Fans of Scotland and Australians, people that were in Marseille, I spoke to a lot of them, I just canvassed opinion on the red card. And I think this is something we've talked about. I think, JB, you might have even mentioned it a week or two ago, or one of you did anyway. The difference in the assessment of, like, rugby nauseous like us who watch every minute, and people, the vast majority of people that will have been tuning in to watch that game last night,
so
having
glad
not
you
watched
said
the
this.
Game.
So glad you said this. Go on.
We go, oh, the tackle framework, yes, World Rugby's framework, that's red card, blah, blah, blah. But it's quite interesting how big a departure that is from where the average fan's head is, because a lot of people cannot get their head around how that is a red card, particularly how, because it's a framework thing and this flow chart we've got, that Tom Curry one was a red card and Santi Carreras wasn't, and it just that's the bit that's pickling people's head. They're like, what? I don't understand, and surely accidents are allowed to happen, is the general sentiment.
Yes. I'm so glad you said this, because I've got a couple of text messages here. This is direct to me, not including all the group ones, so two stood out for me. And the thing is about these text messages is they're coming from lads that previously absolutely loved rugby.
Played rugby, watched it.
Yeah, I'd cast one of the... It's both these guys are absolute nauseous when it comes to rugby. Both of them have drifted away from the game. So one was just... I've not heard from my friend Lawrence for a little while. I saw him when Coldy got promoted. But simply this, rugby can surely not sustain this level of nonsense around the head area. Correct. Absolutely correct. Another one, just simply, the game's gone. And they're right. You know, they're absolutely right. Because it is a high-impact, high-contact game. These laws have been changed by people who, yes, this is what they'll do. They'll say that the laws have been changed by World Rugby, but then they'll say, and it's also been agreed by all of these people who've done really great things in the game. I think Richie McCaw was on some panel. There's a couple of South African legends on the panel.
There'll be coaches, there'll be players.
I don't give a shit. Like, your job is to play and coach. Right, and just appropriating, the reason that they use these names is so they can browbeat people that think something differently and go, well, you don't think you know more than Richie McCaw, do you? Actually, yes, I do. I actually think that I know more. Because when you're getting those texts, it's obvious. If you bothered just listening to people that watched the game and played it across all levels, not just the super elite guys, with a very precise mandate of what they have to conclude, then you go, well, this is nonsense. Like, we're trying to play a contact sport here. The absolute perverseness of this, we must change behaviours, or well, it is made up by people that don't have a clue about the game and do not have its best interest in heart. Who are they trying to appeal to? Rugby appeals to people that used to play it and people that appreciate watching men smash into each other. If you dilute that with your stupid nonsense about changing behaviour, you're going to have exactly what you've got now. People that don't understand the game and switch off.
There's potentially one middle ground we could find, because this is the one thing I think. It's like, I was kind of resigned to, okay, fine, that's a red card. But the thing that I have mentioned this before, so I won't go on about it, but the thing that really bothers me about this is less so actually that it's a red card now. I'm kind of resigned to it a little bit. And I saw Kieran Brooks outside the stadium and chatted to him as well. And he's playing up the road in Toulon. He turned up in an old school vintage BT Cellnet England shirt.
Oh, awesome. Which was really wicked. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, it was great. So I chatted to him and his perspective was kind of like, it's just where it is now, isn't it? It's just the way it goes. If you make contact, so he sounded kind of like that. Players just accept that's how it is, and I'm kind of resigned. But what I was going to say is, missing games, like, the punishment was enough on the night, and I just don't think that 2-3-4 week suspensions is going to actually solve any problem. It's not going to change behaviour. Nope. It's just going to mean that a player misses out on a World Cup final, the pinnacle of their very career, because of one of these incidental accidents, which Tom Curry had some control over, but sometimes things are going to happen that they don't have control over, and that's the bit we dislike.
I sort of flex on this. Sometimes people can persuade me they do have control, other times I don't know. I mean, surely the ultimate incentive not to hit someone in the head with your own head. Like, it's just...
it's the damage to your own head.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure if Tom Curry designed that hit, he wouldn't choose that one. So it can't be on purpose.
Yeah.
Like, if he chose what he wanted to do in the perfect world, it would not be that hit. So let's pretend that this fucking nonsense about changing behaviour is a real thing. It's not. Tom Curry is a top-level professional, a top-level athlete with incredible body control. He didn't do that because he's reckless or violent or doesn't care about, head injuries. He just did that because it's a rugby incident. And we need to start accepting rugby incidents happen, get rid of all of the people who are lobbying rugby from a third-party lobbyist sort of pressure group stance, carry on with it.
Stable doors, horse bolted, mate. This is a futile thing to argue for.
Well, I guess this is the point.
I'm taking a more pragmatic approach. It's like, can we not have players missing games for stuff like this? It's like, fine, they go off in the game, but can we not have it so Tom Curry doesn't play again in the pool stages?
Yeah, I'll tell you why it won't work, because there is no such thing as middle ground, unfortunately. I wish there was, but there's not. So what you said about people being resigned, I mean, that is so often the case. And you see it across all sorts of stuff in rugby, whether it be the Exeter brand being changed or, you know, it's the tackle height. People give up. They get fatigued. And like you're saying now, it's like, oh, well, I'm resigned to it. Kieran Brooks always resigned to it. Like, that's why there needs to be a voice that constantly and forcefully argues this is the way forward. Because when people realise that someone is fighting this case and it's not futile, then things will change. Otherwise, we just carry on drifting the way that World Rugby go. The most worrying thing for me this week, by far, is I'm in like three or four rugby groups. One of the groups, which is actually set up
for the purpose of communicating about rugby, two of the guys who played for the longest time didn't even know the World Cup was starting this week. They didn't know the World Cup was starting this week. I went to the club last night, Tock H, and if this was England football playing, it would have been bouncing. It was half empty. I thought, like, 4 years ago, this would have been rammed.
Yeah.
This would have been rammed, and it just wasn't. It's worrying. It's really worrying. And World Rugby have to take all the blame for this. And what they'll say is they just want to attract new people to the game. Where are the new people? Where are all the people that were going to flood to the game because the game is now safer? Or because head injuries are... Where were the mothers? Where are all the mothers, Tim? I thought mothers would be flooding through the door to buy pints and watch rugby at the club. They weren't there.
So I've got two additional frustrations about this, about the Elliot Daly red card. Elliot Daly. Tom Curry red card. I was just looking at a picture of Elliot Daly. My two frustrations are this. I think had the high tackle framework head contact process actually been followed in the bunker, which is the purpose of the bunker, to allow them the time. They've got 10 minutes to apply the process. I think that this should be a yellow card. It should be mitigated down. And I think that will probably be what happens in the week, unless World Rugby seek to appeal and appeal, because I think there will be an England appeal on this. And the reason for this, I've got it in front of me here. Question number one, has head contact occurred? Yes. Question two, was there foul play? Yes. Question three, what was the degree of danger? High. Red card. Question four, is there any mitigation, of which the second point is sudden and significant drop or movement? The player, the Malia, in the period between catching the ball and landing and getting hit, he is, I don't know, 4 feet off the ground, and he is dropping out of the air. So his movement is both sudden and significant.
Yes.
Like, I can't see how that doesn't apply unless you're saying, well, Tom Curry should predict the precise location of his head and mitigate from that point.
Get Owen Farrell's legal team on the case.
I actually think so that is frustration number one. I think yellow card probably would have been fair for that, given that mitigation.
Here is the new, yeah. Go on, sorry.
Yeah, and point number two is one that I've mentioned this so many times in the past, probably not for quite a while, but it drives me wild. The talk in comms on it by people who are supposed to be involved in the game.
Supposed to is a great way to put it.
Yeah, supposed to be.
Allegedly.
Sir Clive, as one person who 20 years ago was heavily involved in the game. Now, I'm not sure if he ever watches any rugby these days, apart from when he gets paid thousands and thousands of pounds.
Well, he didn't know who Worcester were.
Yeah, exactly. But the talk around, well, there's no malice, there's no intent. And it's like, it drives me absolutely wild because it's... It is so irrelevant to the process.
You would forgive him, wouldn't you, if he said something like, "I know by the process, red card, but there's no malice, there's no intent. This would not be red card under my schemes. I think it's ridiculous." You know, if you put World Rugby on blast, using those terms, they'd be very powerful because it's coming from a World Cup winning coach. But because he clearly doesn't know what he's talking about, it's worthless.
Yeah, it's total. And that's not just. I'm not just directing that point at Sir Clive. It's kind of anyone who mentions malice or intent on a decision like that, it's just hot air.
Yeah.
Like it's irrelevant.
Well, the other side of that coin is the comms people that say things like, well, it is for their safety now. Well, don't play the game. like Tim's point, the resignation, like the centrist dad approach to rugby. I would have a different process, and I think the process would cover most penalties, actually, rather than just high tackles. But we'll do it for the high tackle. So, first of all, has contact occurred with the head? Yes. Next decision point. Was this a rugby incident? This is completely at the discretion of the referee at the time. If the answer is yes, go sideways, maximum sanction, penalty.
So that is kind of question two, because question two is, was there any foul play?
That's different.
Well, but that is a related to, because if it is just, like, if two players are just running along and they happen to bump heads, that's an obvious example of a They're not looking where they're going. They bump shoulders. There is some head-to-head contact. That is just an example of a rugby incident.
Yes, it is. But I think by precedent, it has been interpreted as foul play almost by definition has head contact occurred, almost does seem like foul play now. So I think it's been redefined by its existing use.
Yeah, I think I've seen it, and I can't think of any good incidents. I've seen it more used in line with what you're just trying to point. But yeah, it's a good point. We should probably have a better framework of that, a better explanation of was there foul play?
Yeah,
if you frame it as, was it a rugby incident, that is probably a better way of framing the same question.
Yeah, so if it's a rugby incident, and what classifies as a rugby incident, it means something that occurred which was not intentional. I have no time for punching or stamping or actual foul play, or if it's shoulder to head without a wrap, it can't be that is foul play, because they should have worked on tackle technique 3 weeks ago to hit 2 foot lower. That can't be it. It can't be that. No, not having it in any way. Another way to look at it is, would the player have decided to use that technique if he had complete control over everything? No, he wouldn't. Because we know what players... You've got to give the players some sort of benefit of the doubt that they're not just out there to cause grievous bodily harm to each other.
They're not just lumps of meat just floating around in the ether that occasionally come into contact. They have some control. There we go. Right.
But it is trashing the game.
Tim, from your time in the stadium yesterday, live, our man on the ground, is there any other observations on this game?
Just a couple of things from outside of the stadium and inside. Argentinian fans are absolutely wild. I've never been to a game that Argentina have played in. Their fans are amazing. They turn up really early to the ground. They're so loud. They're bouncing around. They're so much fun. And I spoke to one guy who travelled 28 hours and spent a month's salary to get here. And what he was served up was just... Yeah, I just felt sorry for those fans, to be honest. They were amazing. And there were some issues with people getting into the ground.
Yeah.
I remember it was about half an hour before kickoff, and I was just looking out the window out onto the street on the top level where I was at. And I was like, those guys, they are not getting in. It was the number of people arriving and adding to the crowd was way more than the people that were actually getting through all the security checks. There were people that missed the first 15, 20 minutes of that match.
So, the Times covered this, and they had the subheading, thousands of people missed the first 10 minutes, including players' families. And I'm not sure if that's more or less important. I don't know why that needs to be... am I meant to be more outraged or less outraged that, some poor sap from some town somewhere has spent God knows how much money to get here and can't get in, compared to the players' parents have probably seen them play multiple times and are on comps.
On a freebie.
Yeah. Oh no, the players' family can't get in. Shut up.
And it's their son. They should be there 2 hours before.
Exactly. What? They were bad parents. They can't get in. Good. Good.
But so I was sat next to in the stadium. I don't know if you've mentioned this already, but Charlie Morgan, you love.
Yeah, we are big Charlie Morgan fans.
How was Morgs?
He was on good form, and I've stolen a few opinions that he had that I've just now passed off as my own, because he's just a great rugby mind.
It's good to see it working that way around for once.
Yes, thank God,
for the first time.
Well, and then second and third hand, it will get passed on. You'll start hearing it pop up in other places.
Exactly.
after I've used Charlie Morgan stuff, you'll then hear you'll hear all the usual suspects palming that off as their own. So it all goes back to Charlie Morgan.
Exactly. Hey, if you want your views to come up in the mainstream press, send us an email of what you want us to say, and then you can read your own views later on in the week.
Lads, but the stadium was pumping out some sound. It's now gone quiet. I've got to record some stuff, so I'm going to have to go while there's a window where it's quiet enough to do it.
Fantastic.
Before you go, Tim, and I know you just want to get off, as you very, very curtly said to me yesterday, what's on your agenda today? Because I want to know what you're doing.
What I'm doing is I'm sitting in this sweatbox recording some radio stuff. I've got a call into TalkSport in a little bit, and then I'm going to go for... I haven't even had breakfast today. Then I'm going to go for a coffee and some food. I'm right next to the stadium, so I'll go to somewhere around the corner, and then I'll come back to watch the first game. What's the first game today?
Don't know, but Wales are at 5:35.
No, well, Wales Fiji is the 9 PM.
Watching Scotland.
South Africa v Scotland at 5:45. What's the first game?
Japan versus Chile.
That's it. Japan, Chile. I watched that in the media room in the stadium, which has got air conditioning, and I can plug all my stuff in again and get it charged up.
All right,
and then I'll be watching South Africa Scotland. And
so one of your
that's the game I'm most excited about. That's going to be incredible.
So one of your videos this week, Tim, you have to do it in the style of Graham Hunter, with an espresso and a French paper out in front of you.
James Richardson.
Sorry, James Richardson. Yeah.
Yes. Gazzetta dello Sport.
Yes.
I'll get the French newspaper and take people through the back pages.
Yes, go on, do it.
I won't know what's going on, I'll just make it up.
You can tell so much from the pictures. I read a story in Spain about a massive drugs haul just by the pictures, and you pick up like X amount of kilograms. Well, that must be the drugs, because it wasn't the weight of the police officer.
I saw the headline in L'Equipe after France's huge victory over New Zealand, and it's basically it was French fair, so a play on French flair, but fair being iron. So French iron, which I thought was very, very good.
That is good. How did you find that?
I just saw it on Twitter. Someone had posted it. Enjoyed that.
Very good.
Very good.
Well, you get off, mate, and we'll catch you tomorrow morning.
Pleasure. I'll speak to you probably tomorrow or sometime.
Tomorrow evening, maybe.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Right, well, that's Tim Cocker departed with. I guess we should talk a little bit about... We did not do Australia, Georgia, or have we?
I mentioned it a tiny, tiny bit, both in the stats and Georgia being slightly disappointed with themselves. But so I watched most of this game. Australia did some nice things. They scored a few nice tries. Ben Donaldson looked good. Nwanga Nitawase.
Yeah.
Looked very good. A couple of nice offloads, a couple of big, strong carries. And Australian scrum looking good as well. Georgia, though, there's a couple of mistakes, particularly in the second half, when Nineashvili breaks down through the middle and the Mr. T, the winger, the right winger, is screaming down the right wing. And if Nineashvili goes right and finds the pass, Tabuzadze goes in the corner. Instead, he offloads it to Taniela Tupou, who passes it to Ben Donaldson. And it was a 14-point swing at a time where Georgia were maybe 12 points behind. And if that goes in, and then slightly later than that, Georgia breaking down the left wing and blew a chance. So those two scores, if one doesn't go a 14-point swing to Australia and Georgia get the second one, Australia will be under a lot more pressure. Now, obviously, it didn't go that way, and it's a handy 20-point win for Australia. But Georgia will be disappointed with that. And I think Georgia have got a shot at scalping either Wales or Fiji. And I kind of hope the little round robin between those four teams... I think Australia will beat everyone. But then Georgia, Wales and Fiji, I could see... one win for each of those teams, and it comes down to points difference and bonus points for who goes through behind Australia.
So we're going to find out what Wales are all about today.
Can't wait for that game.
It'll be good, isn't it?
Yeah.
And mind you, Scotland, South Africa is going to be a belter.
I've got this feeling about Scotland.
I have as well.
I don't know what it is.
I've completely got the same feeling.
I don't know what it is.
But I hope they save it for Ireland rather than South Africa.
I quite like them to do. I like this Scotland team. There's quite a lot to like, and also quite a lot not to like. But I just love Finn Russell, and I love some of the boys they've got there.
You can't look at Scotland like a conventional rugby team, okay? In the same way, you can't look at the Taliban as a conventional army, right? They're going to fight this thing very, very differently.
It's a hell of an analogy.
Yeah, rugby Taliban, Scotland.
They are going to be different, but they've got a lot of good pieces as well. They've got a solid pack. They've got some really good running threats in the pack and across the back line.
Well, they're just unusual. They've got unusual talent. They've got unmatchable unusual talent, whether that be Duan. I mean, you could match You could match Doohan, but it'd be one hell of a government-sponsored project to do so.
I mean, who in... Besides Doohan, who is the next big strong wing? Maybe James Lowe? Maybe Pinot?
I mean, he's in a different league. Yeah. I mean, he's different. I mean, he's not better than those boys. And in the same way, Finn Russell is not the best fly half in the world.
Yeah.
But he's different. And that's the thing, isn't it? It's difference.
Like 8 years ago in 2015, you'd say Julian Surveyor. Julian Surveyor won.
Probably the closest. Won,
yeah. I can't think of... Maybe one of the Fijian boys. But even not even their wingers. You'd be more talking like Tui Sova or
Tuisova was the one I was thinking
or,
of. Not the same thing.
Naya Salivu.
Radranda, to be fair, the way he plays centre, it would be exactly the same way that...
Doohan would play centre.
Doohan would play centre.
Yeah. Like,
and also the same way that most number eights would play centre.
Yeah, Gregory Aldridge.
Yeah, he'd play centre in the same way as them. So, that'd be that. They're just unusual. That's the best thing that I can say about them. Everything about them is unusual.
So I'm doing a Super Brew League, and I've currently got South Africa to win, but the closer it gets to kick-off, I'm edging towards a Scotland win.
I'm telling you, it's Ireland that are going to come and struck. Because I think South Africa have got the overall talent to overcome this and just sheer massiveness, sheer brute force and individual talent in excess of what Ireland have. Ireland rely on organisation, togetherness, teamwork, all really good things, but all things that can come really unstuck when you get punched in the mouth a few times by Finn Russell.
But Ireland also do have a secretly, and I've said made this point for a while, a secretly enormous team.
They
and
are,
that,
yeah.
That back row of Tyburn, Peter Romani and Caelan Torres is absolutely massive.
It's not South Africa big, though, is it?
I don't think it's far off that South Africa back row.
So, I don't know. So South Africa are big, but the other thing they have in their favour is extreme violence.
If it was that three, that Ireland three, versus Peter Steptoe, Khaleesi and Jasper Visser, then the Ireland back three is bigger than...
But you take out Jasper Visser and place him with Dwayne Vermaelen.
But then Khaleesi is the smallest one of the whole six.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. But hang on, Quagga Smith comes in, he's smaller again.
He's smaller again.
But then he is supremely violent.
Yeah.
Like, supremely...
And his work around the breakdown is amazing.
Yeah. In the same way that Hamish Watson is supremely violent.
Yeah.
You know, you want that kind of... that unhingedness about the way that you play. It's hard to... When you play with a guy like this... So we've got a guy, or did have a guy at Talk H, who plays... I just can't describe the amount of force that they generate.
Someone from last night, Ben Earl. Ben Earl is not a particularly big bloke.
No, he's not.
But he throws his weight around. He's so explosive with it.
I wish... And that's kind of why I wish we could have seen Ben Curry for a little longer, because he is supremely physical.
Tom Curry. But same.
Sorry, same. A generic Curry.
Yeah, one
Mrs.
of them.
Mrs. Curry, Mr. Curry.
Mr. and Mrs. Curry don't even know which one's which anyway, yeah, so it doesn't matter.
And they're both supremely violent too.
The final game that we've not really touched on, which we don't really need to touch on, is Ireland hammered Romania.
Yeah, I don't have anything to say about this.
80 points. I only watched a little bit of this. I happened to watch the first 5 minutes where Romania went 5 points up, which I thought, come on.
Here we go.
So 5 points after 3 minutes. I can do the maths. This is going to be over 100 points to nil to Romania.
Imagine.
Sadly, it didn't quite work out.
Did they not have our friend Vlad Iannucci reffing the game? That would have helped, wouldn't it, boys?
They didn't have a Romanian referee.
Oh, what a shame.
Which is a pity, because that might have levelled things up a bit.
Yeah, last thing you want to see, if you're in that group with Romania, is a Romanian referee. If Romania even have a remote chance of qualifying, and they roll out a Romanian referee, all bets are off.
There we go. So we're going to enjoy the rugby today. Three games today. Watch out for a couple of upsets. Watch out for Chile doing a lot better than people think. Watch out for... three upsets. Watch out for Scotland and watch out for Fiji. Which to us wouldn't really be an upset, but to some people might be. And then we will record again tomorrow evening.
Or morning. Or evening.
Well, I'm kind of working tomorrow morning. So
this comes out today.
This comes out today.
Sunday.
Yes.
What do people have to listen to on Friday?
On Monday morning, they'll have this.
Fine. Okay, then. We're done.
Beautiful.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.